From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. One of the classic sounds of summer, kids splashing in public swimming pools, is heard less this year and could be heard even less next year. That's because budget cuts meant about half of Sacramento's pools never opened this summer. And if the budget doesn't get better, even more will stay closed next summer. But public pools can be more than just a nice place to hang out. They're really important in neighborhoods where children have fewer options. Capital Public Radio's environment reporter Joe Rubin investigated this. You might have heard the first of his two-part report this morning. Part two airs tomorrow. He's looking into how many pools are closed and why they're closed. I asked Joe how many pools are closed this summer in Sacramento.
Right now, there are 6 of 13 pools are closed, and actually 7 are closed for public swimming. So more than half actually are shuttered.
And you've heard that more could be closed next year.
Yeah, I mean, it looks at this point pretty certain. What the city says is that 3 of 18 pools will be open. And that's including some of these wonderful play pools, which are these exploding concrete mushrooms, which are create kind of a waterfall effect.
So the number of pools available to people is already significantly down. It's going to be down a lot more next year. You went to some pools, both open and closed, to find out what people were saying about that. And what did you hear?
Actually, some people are still showing up at places like Southside Park and in disbelief that, like, the downtown park in Sacramento that so many people visit and there's no other public pools around is closed for the summer. We went to another park, Bertha Henschel Park, where there's one of these mushroom splash pools. And people there are aware that this is probably going to be closed next summer. On the day I visited, it was hot, and there was about 40 kids in there. And we talked to one mom, and let's listen to what she said.
They're taking away all the things that are helpful for this age, like the First 5 program, just because they want to help other things. It's so ridiculous. Yeah. The young people of the community are really important, and I wish they would focus on that more.
So this mother, not too happy about what's happening. I'm guessing she's not the only one.
Yeah, I'd say that people are upset across the city. We spent a lot of time in Oak Park, where actually the pool is open for the moment, but that's pool scheduled to be closed next year as well.
How did Oak Park manage to avoid the cut this year?
Well, it was originally on the chopping block, and the city council, from what I understand, said, hey, this is a really economically hard-hit neighborhood. Let's try and find a way to keep it open. So they did manage to keep it open this year, but next year it's on the chopping block. And I think one of the things that I found is that people are frustrated with the city, and they say that they need to be more creative and empower the community to find solutions for themselves. I talked to one guy, Carl Pinkston, who is an interesting guy. I think he's a former Black Panther and also works on anti-gang projects with youth in the neighborhood. And he said something interesting, just kind of like reflecting back on history, that he felt like that people in the community had the power to maybe run their own pools.
I remember the days when the Sacramento Area Black Caucus used to have this event called the Unity Festival, and it was held at Miller's Park, which is you have the Sacramento River flowing swiftly by, and we would have tens of thousands of people out in the park, and we never once had anyone drown or lose anyone in the river. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you that when people are empowered to take responsibility for their action, people will do it. You can make these things happen if you're prepared to do what is necessary to train young people to be lifeguard, to train them to manage youth. But what happened is over the years, cities become so fearful. They have all these insurance rules, all these legal rules, all these barriers, artificial barriers, that I think are really unnecessary if they really want communities to really to make things happen.
Now, we have to note here that some people do, in fact, drown in the river. But I guess his point here is that they could get rid of some red tape and allow pools to open and just basically empower the community to watch out for themselves.
Yeah, and you know, he's not actually the only person who said that. And I think that Mr. Pinkston would recognize that, you know, you need to have insurance and that people need to be trained. And let me say this. I think it's easy to point fingers at the city and say, oh, you know, come on, you know, get with the program here. How can you have only 3 of 18 pools in the city open? It's ridiculous. But I think if you really look at it, the budget to have all these pools open for swim lessons, for public swimming, 6 days a week, is $1.7 million. And I think that that's a pretty good use of public funds and not exorbitant. I think the problem is the crisis is so extreme that, and you have had so many layoffs in the Parks Department, that you're having kind of senior people oversee a crisis. And in some ways, it's almost like you need to look at the situation like it's a startup. Like, how can we really, you know, just kind of tear up the rule book here? There's another young guy I met who, named Isaac Gonzalez, he lives in Tahoe Park. And something that I learned is that without people like Isaac Gonzalez, our parks would be in even more blight right now. And he's doing incredible things in terms of volunteering. Let's listen to a little bit of a conversation I had with him.
You seem like a pretty resourceful person. You think if someone gave you, say, $30,000, you think you could keep this pool going?
Well, I'll tell you, I got a $1,000 grant to clean this park earlier this year. That I wrote up a grant for $1,000 to buy tools. I bought the tools. I got a coupon so I could save 10% on top of that. I did it all in my spare time. I cleaned out a shed, a community shed, so that we could store it for free. I did that all on my own time. Yes, you could be very, if you're willing to be adaptive and if you're willing to actually get some real results, there's a lot of things you can do. But when you're stuck in the stringent policies of labor contracts and the, you know, entitlements, there's only so much you can do. You know, there's just only so much you can do in the current environment. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a way to do it if people are willing to be flexible, if people are willing to start thinking in new ways to provide these services. But like I said, That's the third rail, you know, in this town.
Let's clarify the number of pools here. Is it 13 or 18?
Yeah, it's the total number of pools is 18, and that includes some of these play pools, like at Bertha Henschel Park or in Land Park. And I have to say, I'm a fan of these. My daughter, I have two girls, and the older one who's 6 now. I mean, she just grew up loving them, and it's one of the things that made me love the city was just seeing her interacting there. Exploring and in you know, such a multicultural place, and I do find it, you know, tough to know that all at this point all of those play pools, the 5 play pools are slated to be closed, and 10 of the 13 larger pools will be closed next summer.
And if I may ask, what do your daughters think about all this?
Well, you know, I don't bring work home that much, you know, because I'm the environmental reporter here and things are grim. But I mean, she's very green. You know, one day she came home and said, you know, she was out picking trash, you know, because she wants to be more green. So I think, you know, they she knows what I do, but I don't talk about it that much.
Pools could hit home for a 6-year-old,
yeah,
though.
But let me say this about my daughter is that I have a very distinct memory of being with her at Southside Park and seeing her play under one of these mushrooms. And that was, I just was kind of etched in my mind. It's like, wow, what a wonderful place. And just seeing her at 4 years old running around there. And I never mentioned that to her. And this year when she was in kindergarten, her kindergarten teacher had a project asking, what's your favorite place in the world? And she's traveled, you know, had some opportunities to travel and been to some wonderful places with us. And, you know, I was really kind of blown away and kind of moved that she said her favorite place in Sacramento are these mushrooms, wow, which are all supposed to be closed next summer. And so I think that sort of inspired me to get out there and do some stories about it. You know, not so much for my family, but just for all of the kids around Sacramento and all the people who use these pools.
My guest is Joe Rubin, Capital Public Radio's environment reporter. He's working on a 2-part series of stories. The first one aired this morning during Morning Edition about the budget cuts in Sacramento that are forcing the closure, or at least the not opening, of many of the city's public pools, including in some lower income areas where kids have many fewer options. Well, we've heard from some activists who got opinions on all of this. What about What does the city say in response?
I think that the city, it does not feel to me like it's a very unified response in the sense of, you know, they say they're open to ideas. I talked to this guy, Dave Mitchell, who basically runs the pools for the city. And he says, well, maybe we could turn them into cabana clubs in some ways. And they are open to fundraising. But there's also, as you'll hear in the reports, there's some real frustration, such as a woman in Southside Park who was originally told, and she's a very experienced fundraiser, and she was told, okay, if you raise $20,000, we can keep this pool open. And then they called her on the phone, and they said, sorry, you would have had to actually raise $80,000 and have raised that by last month. And I should also say that the Neighborhood Association used to meet in a field house, which is closed now. So it's pretty deflating, I think, for people who are trying to keep these parks from being blighted and trying to be organized. And I think that, you know, it's also bringing up some very hard feelings. And in Oak Park, I had people remind me of the fact, something I didn't know, that pools were segregated at one point in Sacramento. And the NAACP had to come in the 1950s and appeal that to make sure that all kids had access to every pool in Sacramento. And now I think there's a feeling that the poor and minorities are being hit particularly hard by these budget cuts. And again, Carl Pinkston, who works with these youth, he's trying in earnest to keep them away from gangs. I spoke to him about that. Let's listen to something that he said.
I feel that people of color are not human. And what they mean by that is not human is that they feel that the resources should go for law enforcement and control versus prevention, recreational program, employment. So when you don't see anyone as human, you just see them as animal that should be locked up and kept away from your property and your kids. If you see them as human, you begin to say, listen, they need to have the same things we have. They should have recreational program. They should have the pool should be open. The park should be open. They should have employment and job because they are an important asset of our community, and that is priority versus law and order.
Finally, Joe, in your story tomorrow morning, part of that is about how the city of Sacramento basically said to this woman in the Southside Park area, they basically turned down her offer to raise money and contribute money to help keep their pool open. What's that about?
Well, her ideas were actually pretty cool. I mean, she wanted to turn the pool into like a nightclub one night and have dancing there and have it be kind of a high-class event in order to raise money. She wanted to have a mosaic that people would contribute to and contribute money to have their names attached to. She's an experienced fundraiser. You know, I guess I would just say, I would reiterate that I think that there needs to be more focus on this and that I think that the people at the Parks and Recreation, let's not trash them. I think they've done a wonderful job over generations keeping these pools running at a reasonable cost. But I think that, you know, it's a kind of fundamental quality of life having your parks and your pools open. And I think that this, in order to get on top of this, there's probably got to be some kind of point person. There probably has to be a real attention from the mayor on an issue like this, bringing some of his skills, bringing private enterprise in. And this is something, this is not my opinions. These are opinions that I heard kind of around the city that it's very scattershot right now. And so I think it's a tough situation. I think it's a serious situation.
Joe Rubin, Capital Public Radio's environment reporter, joined us to talk about his investigation into the closure and the non-opening of public pools in Sacramento. You can listen to his story that aired this morning at our website, capradio.org. The second part will air tomorrow morning during Morning Edition. Joe, thanks for joining us.
It's always a pleasure, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, more on the closing of public pools and the impact of that on communities. We'll talk about the budget angle and the political implications with a Sacramento City Councilman. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today on Talk of the Nation, the price of cheating. Administrators and teachers in almost half of Atlanta's schools tampered with test scores to make their schools look better. Some face charges. The chair of Atlanta schools says the victims are children. Talk of the Nation starts at 11 right after Insight. Well, earlier this morning, we heard how many public swimming pools in Sacramento never opened this summer because of budget cuts and how even more could stay closed next year. But pools are vital to many neighborhoods, especially those with fewer options for kids. How did it get to this point and what can be done? Joining us to talk about this is a Sacramento City Councilman. He's Kevin McCarty, represents District 6 in the city's southeast, including Tahoe Park. Kevin McCarty, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Jeffrey. It's good to be here. I'm glad here to talk about our city and our pools, but I thought you want to call me and talk about redistricting this morning, since that's a big topic, but maybe we'll save that for another day.
Well, I was going to ask you a question about that, but let's start with the pools, since that was the topic earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
When you and the rest of the city council were working on the current year budget, how did you evaluate public pools compared to other city services?
Well, first of all, it's been a very troubling budget years for the past three or four, and our Parks and Recreation Department, their budget has essentially gone from roughly $30 million a few years ago to about 10. So the services have just been eviscerated. All youth sports recreation programs for the city of Sacramento are eliminated. Many of our pools have been shut down. And we've had to make some really difficult decisions, including laying off police officers and firefighters. So, you know, we had to balance this approach. Some actually had suggested that we close down all the pools and half of our community centers. But I think the council said that would be a wrong decision. And so we essentially were able to keep them open on a shoestring budget.
How did you decide which pools to keep open and which ones to keep closed?
Well, I think we did kind of like what the Congress and the military did with base closures last decade or so, is try not to politicize it, but based upon, you know, just analysis and stats and geography. So we looked over the years to see which pools had the highest attendance. We plotted them throughout a map throughout the city, and we wanted to make sure we had pools that stayed open in every area throughout the city and geography-wise. Unfortunately, for my council district, I had three pools in my district. Two are shut down this year, and it was disappointing. But I supported the city decision because they made a case, I think, that there are other pools in neighboring communities which are open. So it made sense as far as geography.
And it made sense because those pools were used more often, or because someone made the decision that those pools should stay open because they're more important to the neighborhood.
No, I think we based upon on pool usage. They really tried to do a thoughtful analysis of this, going back, looking at the counts for pool attendance in the past summers. And, you know, it's difficult to close out any of these pools, but I support the decision that they made. But, you know, we're going to try to reverse this. We're going to try to find ways, including looking at some innovative ways, which you discussed on your earlier segment, to get the community involved, because having these pools shut down is not good for our community, for our city. Look, it's we've had a mild summer, but when it gets hot, it gives kids something to do, and it keeps kids out of trouble as well. You know, summer hours and summer time is a time when, you know, a lot of kids don't have productive things to do, and this is something that we need to have in our community.
Do you see any possibility of pools being turned over to nonprofit groups, community groups, whatever?
We would love that. We would love that. I think the biggest issue overarching, Jeffrey, is that city government and, frankly, governments as a whole, we're not going to be able to operate like we used to. We just don't have the revenues. Times have changed. The economy is dictating this. We don't have the revenues to do things like we used to. So we're going to have to think outside of the box. We're doing that right now with community centers, and we'll take a look at that with pools as well. The problem with pools, as you can imagine, there's all kinds of safety issues and liability. You can't just turn a pool over one day to a community group to watch it and say, oh, they'll be out there with a couple lifeguards, because, you know, the city could be at risk if something happened tragically. And so we need to make sure that these make sense. Plus, you know, pools are very costly to run with their chemicals and maintenance and upkeep. So it is an expensive endeavor. I think they say roughly that it's about $10,000 to $20,000 a month to keep a pool open. And so it's hard for some of these neighborhoods to raise money to do it. Some have and some haven't. So we need to look for innovative ways to try to fix this issue.
My guest is Kevin McCarty, Sacramento City Councilman, who represents District 6 in the city's southeast, including Tahoe Park. You mentioned redistricting earlier on, and let's turn to that now. The city of Sacramento, just like all jurisdictions, is redrawing its political maps. And for state legislative districts and congressional districts, there's been a citizens commission that was given the job of redrawing the maps, and those maps will be finalized today. In the city of Sacramento, the council appointed a citizens advisory committee, received the recommendations, but then ultimately it's the council that makes its own decisions. And several maps have appeared from the council, and it looks like a map that was not based on something that the advisory committee did will end up being the final map for Sacramento City Council districts. Looking back over that process, what changes would you have made if you knew then what you know now?
Well, it's an interesting question, Jeffrey, because I'm the one who pushed the creation of this citizen advisory body, and I think it worked. I think they were able to help vet out the issues, understand where some of the push and pull points were throughout the city. But your final conclusion, I respectfully would differ. I think that the map that's being debated at city council right now, put forward by Councilmember Steve Cohn, takes all of the elements that were put forth in these citizen committee maps and kind of gives the greatest hits type of thing, you know. And if you look at one of their maps, their preferred map, I think it was called Map D, Councilmember Cohn's map, almost to a T, follows that in six of the eight council districts. The real issue is how you balance the north area where all the growth is with some of the areas north of the river. So, you know, I think that we did it justice. You know, certainly we can take a look 10 years from now if we want to do a larger, charter review of how these things are done. But in this process, you know, redistricting is never simple. Changing boundaries and changing lines have been complicated for decades and bring out a lot of emotion. So I think it's par for the course what we're seeing here in the city of Sacramento.
At least one member of the Sacramento Advisory Committee seems unhappy with how things have turned out, though. I'm talking about Steve Maviglio. He wrote a letter that was published in the Sacramento Bee a couple of days ago, and he didn't actually come out and say this process was messed up in the end, but reading between the lines, he seemed to be unhappy with how it turned out, with what appeared to be the city council saying thank you to the advisory committee and then coming up with maps that were maybe only partly derived from the advisory committee's work. What would you say to any members of the advisory committee who aren't happy with how this turned out?
I would first say thank them. Thank you for their work. I think we have thanked them. I think they did a lot of work that would not have been done at the city council. You know, they spent 40-plus hours studying these issues and coming up, fine-tuning some real nuanced issues that we probably wouldn't have been able to dig into up there at the dais at a regular city council meeting. And I know there was some dissension among some of the committee members. I know that I believe the chair and the vice chair of the advisory committee support what's happening right now at the city council, and they believe that we have been, you know, following the process that we set out in January. But look, we're gonna get through this like we do every decade, and I think we've had more citizen involvement than ever before in this process, and I think that those voices have been heard, and we're incorporating those issues into our final maps, which I think was the course that we set out 6 months ago.
Now, these final maps ultimately are being decided by the members of the city council, and from the point of view of someone who's observing it, it looks like sometimes it's a turf war because different council members would like, and it's understandable that they would like, certain things in their district that are influential, important, desirable in one way or another. This, of course, is one of the arguments in favor of turning over redistricting to a citizens commission at the state level as opposed to being determined by elected officials at the city level. Do you think there's merit to having city redistricting run by a citizens commission?
Sure. I think that we couldn't have done it in a short time this year. As we saw with the state, they had an elaborate process where the state auditor went through and vetted candidates, went through a very lengthy, thorough process, and I think that takes time. I don't think we could have just done it in a few weeks early in January. That wouldn't have quite worked. So, sure, we should take a look at that in the next decade. But the bigger issue, what you said earlier, is elected officials pushing for areas for for other reasons. I think the most important thing is we listen to people in different neighborhoods. I mean, right now one of the biggest hiccups in this right now is an area called the Med Center neighborhood next to my district in on the Stockton Boulevard area in Sacramento. And years ago, it was aligned with Oak Park, but after the hospital was built, it became the Med Center neighborhood officially in the late 80s, early 90s. And how I'm viewing this, like anything else I do, is I listen to the people who live there. And I think that's what we should be doing, is listening to the neighborhoods, trying to link communities of interest, and most importantly, is not split up neighborhoods. I think that's what Councilmember Cohn's map does the most. It splits up the least amount of neighborhoods, and I think that's what we're trying to do.
But that Med Center neighborhood includes Sacramento Charter High School, which is a school that's been for decades associated with Oak Park.
It has, but for decades it's been on the official City of Sacramento neighborhood map as the Med Center neighborhood. And I think we ought to respect that history as well, that 25, 30 years ago, the neighbors there created a neighborhood association, and after the hospital was built, they saw a big link with the 13,000 people who work at the hospital, and many of them live in that area, and so they officially changed their name in the 80s, 90s to the Med Center neighborhood, which is listed on our city maps as the official city neighborhood map. And I think we ought to honor those neighborhoods and not second-guess decisions that were made 25 years ago when neighborhoods, you know, worked with themselves and distinguish themselves.
Kevin McCarty, Sacramento City Councilman, represents District 6 in the city's southeast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I always enjoy coming on and chatting.
Thank you. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, after the first summer recess in 5 years, California lawmakers are back on the job today. What's going on at the Capitol? You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us is the man with answers, Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio's senior news editor. He joins us from the newsroom. Alan, what is in the news today?
Well, Jeffrey, you seem to be sitting in the middle of most of it. As you know, the lawmakers are back today. So many laws to be made, so little time to do it. And as you've mentioned, and Ben Adler has, this will be the first time in 5 years, pretty much, that the lawmakers actually got a summer recess. Did they come back tanned, rested, and ready, or are they rusted? We'll find out.
Yes. Well, great. That's in the news today. We'll hear those stories when?
Well, coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered at 3:30. And you might also note, as you have, that the Redistricting Commission comes back with its final map, or its version of what would be a final map, and Marianne Russ will be covering that.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Alan.
My pleasure.
Well, let's stick with that theme of the legislature coming back to work. Whether you think they deserved it or not, California lawmakers actually got a summer recess this year. That's because for once, the state budget was actually passed on time. But summer fun is over, and the legislature officially gets back to work today. Lawmakers are working on lots of bills, and the budget is also still on everyone's mind because fiscally, the year hasn't started according to plan. Also of note at the Capitol today, the official final vote on the state's new political maps. Joining us with details about all this is Ben Adler, Capitol Public Radio state government reporter. He's at our Capitol Bureau downtown. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
Well, the lawmakers, are they looking tanned?
Are they looking to
are they looking
to what?
Tanned and refreshed?
Oh, well, you know, I can answer that question in about an hour and a half when they meet for session. They're still getting into town, and the way things typically work is on Mondays, their first days in town. They have session around noon, and that gives them a chance to get into town. So I'll let you know.
So they have a lot of bills to work on.
They have hundreds and hundreds of bills remaining to get through the legislative process in the next 4 weeks or so. They have a September 9th deadline at which time session will adjourn. After that, if there's anything related to the budget or any other pressing issues involved in special session, the governor can call them into special session or those sessions can continue. But as far as bills that don't have anything to do with the budget, lawmakers do have until, I believe, September 9th. And then that's it. They got to get those bills out of the legislature, out of both chambers, to the governor. And then the governor will have a few weeks to figure out what to do with them.
Well, one of the most talked about issues this year has been public pensions. Is there much action ahead on that?
Inside the building, it is unlikely that there will be a lot that happens. There may be a couple of bills that make some changes to abuses like spiking, pension spiking, and airtime, the practice of purchasing pension credits for years that public employees haven't worked. So you could very well see some bills move forward on that, but we don't know yet. Republicans certainly want to see more changes. There is a constitutional amendment that was introduced by the four Senate Republicans who were in negotiations with Governor Brown, and it's basically what they were hoping to get into a budget deal that did not in the end materialize. And that measure would go much further, but that is almost certainly not going to get anywhere in the Democratic-controlled legislature. I think with pensions, as with maybe some other issues we may discuss, the same sense of, I guess its supporters would say, urgency, and the opponents would say willingness to look at the issue, that's just gone now that a budget deal is off the table.
My guest is Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio state government reporter. The state legislature is back in session today after a summer recess. Any other themes emerging or not emerging that people might have expected to be emerging in all the legislation and other activity at the Capitol this week?
Well, I think over the next few weeks, we're going to see develop what is kind of a typical end of session dash to get the bills done. And you're going to see, given that the budget is at least for now off the table, you're going to see bills ranging from one that would give the state's insurance commissioner the power to regulate health insurance premiums to a bill that would ban restaurants from using styrofoam food containers for takeout. Bills like that, and I can mention a few more if you'd like. But
yeah, go ahead.
Okay, sure. There's one that would require hotels to use fitted sheets. The author says that would reduce housekeepers' lower back injuries. Business groups say it's a nanny state overregulation. There's a bill targeting Walmart and other big box retailers by requiring an extra step in the city or county development process before those projects can be approved, and that step it would be an economic impact report. There's a bill that would ban the use of shark fins in shark fin soup, which is an Asian specialty, and a big lobbying fight over Speaker Perez's bill, Speaker John Perez's bill, to disincorporate the tiny L.A. County city of Vernon, which has come under accusations of corruption. So those are just some. There's, again, hundreds more. And, of course, as SACB columnist Dan Walters pointed out over the weekend, there's bills that are going to just materialize out of thin air. It's going to be through the gut and amend process. In other words, you take a bill that's gone through all the committee hearings and maybe gotten through one full vote in a chamber, rip it to shreds, substitute different language into it because something more urgent comes up than what made it through the first time. And from that point on, you just deal with the new bill.
So right now, lawmakers are focusing on bills, but at some point, the budget, which is kind of like the Frankenstein monster that you can shoot with bullets, but it doesn't die, is going to reemerge because several challenges to the budget that was passed are around already. Revenues have not come in as the official forecast had projected, but there's also the challenges to parts of the overall budget deal. They're going to have to come back to this sooner or later.
You would think so. On the revenues, it's a little hard to say where exactly revenues stand right now. There were conflicting reports last week, and not necessarily that one set of numbers was right or wrong, but the timing in which they were reported. So it may be an oversimplification at this point to say revenues aren't coming in as expected. I think we should probably just keep an open mind and wait and see on that. But certainly, the state Supreme Court last week said that it would rule immediately it would immediately hear arguments on the redevelopment situation, which basically is the state has now basically told redevelopment agencies, you got to choose between helping the state's budget crisis or going out of existence. And the Supreme Court will rule on whether that's a violation of Proposition 22, which voters approved this past fall. And they're going to make a ruling on that before mid-January when the first redevelopment payment is due. So that's $1.7 billion with a gigantic question mark hanging over its head. Also, there's a referenda potentially on the table for the so-called Amazon tax, which is for out-of-state online retailers to collect sales tax, for a fire recovery fee, which is $150 for households in rural areas to help fight wildfires. And who knows what else is going to get questioned at one in one way or another. So, yeah, it's really unclear what kind of, you know, how balanced this budget is, and we'll find out over the months to come.
Well, we're just about out of time, but we should touch on the other big thing happening today at the California Capitol, and that's the final vote from the Citizens Redistricting Commission on their redrawn political maps for the legislature and for Congress and for the Board of Equalization. But this final vote is not going to be the final word.
No, but it actually might be kind of close to it. There may well be some legal challenges, whether it's from interest groups or ethnic groups that feel that they're not really adequately reflected in the maps. Or I know the state Republican Party is planning on challenging the state Senate district maps because those have the potential to give the Democrats a 2/3 majority in that particular chamber. The conventional wisdom is that may not be the case in the assembly, that Democrats may not be able to get that. And of course, that's important because with 2/3 majorities in both chambers and a Democratic governor, the Democrats could raise taxes or put tax measures on the ballot. However, without Republican votes. So you may see that as far as the congressional districts go, in that situation, Democrats are generally supposed to pick up a couple of seats. But we'll see. There could be legal challenges. These maps may well stay in place. We'll see.
Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio State Government Reporter, thanks for joining us with this update.
Sure, no problem.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how a Davis woman ripped out her lawn and grew most of her family's food for a year. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Perhaps, like me, you've imagined living off the fat of the land, but then reality intrudes. Could you really live on the food from your backyard? Well, one Davis family recently learned that they could do it, more or less. Spring Warren ripped out her lawn and grew or raised 3/4 of the family's food. She's written a book about it called The Quarter Acre Farm. When Spring joined us on Insight, I asked how her husband and two sons reacted when she said, "Guess what I'm going to do?"
Well, it wasn't met with full support, to say the least. My eldest son was in full support of it. He worked as a chef at the time, and he was an avid gardener, and he thought this was a great idea. However, he didn't live at home, and so he wasn't going to be forced to take part in it.
Easy for him to say.
Exactly. That's what my younger son said. The younger son said, "You know, you're sort of, this is already in process. It's the summer is full on. Maybe you should take more time, plan ahead, and do it maybe another time," which I thought meant perhaps like after I've gone for college.
Yes.
And my husband said, "Are you crazy? You'll starve," which meant, "Are you crazy? I'll starve."
Yes. So what did they think it would involve? How did they think their diet would change if you actually went ahead with this? And of course, you did go ahead with it.
Yes. Well, they were initially right. The diet changed just the way they thought it was going to, in terms of my preparation was not very good. So that first month that I did this was the month of zucchini. And I think that they sat at the dinner table every night and watched me eat my zucchini in various forms and thought they had called it right. And they were very glad they didn't take part.
Well, how did you change things? How did you turn things around so that you could actually have a balanced and interesting diet for a year?
Well, I had planted a lot more things, a lot more plants. And once they started being in production, then, of course, my diet became much more varied. And it was something then the rest of the family wanted to jump in and take part in.
My guest is Spring Warren of Davis. She's author of The Quarter Acre Farm, How I Kept the Patio, Lost the Lawn, and Fed My Family for a Year. Give people an idea about the amount of space around your home and how much of it you actually dedicated to food production.
Well, our lot is a typical size lot. It's actually not a quarter acre. It's slightly less than a quarter acre. And then of that space, of course, there's the footprint of the house on that less than quarter acre. And there are several patios. There's actually 3 small patios. There's a driveway. There's bushes. There's some trees. And then we have some animals. So they take up part of that space.
So what's left?
So what's left is plenty to grow an entire family's worth of food. It's really amazing how much you can grow in a relatively small space.
I guess you had to keep cycling through crops, because with that amount of space and several hungry people in the household, you had to go through one crop and then quickly plant another one?
Well, there are two periods of time in which the sort of the translation from winter to summer crops happens, and that's a pretty intense time. But as right now, I have all my summer stuff in pretty much, and so there was some number of time in which it was just very intense. You pull out the old stuff and you put the new stuff in, and then all of that just starts producing, and it's amazing. I always say that I wish that houses could work the way that gardens do. Then you could start a door jamb and just sit back and wait, and the house would grow around it.
Yeah.
But that's the way gardens work. You plant it, you sort of prep for it, and you get it going, and then it sort of takes over.
What gave you the idea for this? What motivated you?
I was doing research on my next book, which is set in North Dakota. And so we had driven up toward North Dakota. And during that trip, it was the summer of the Salmonella scare. And so we were driving across country, going to cafes and places, and there wasn't a tomato to be seen. You know, that was like, oh, poison tomatoes, can't eat those. And then they thought, it's not the tomatoes, it's the peppers. Maybe it's not the peppers, maybe it's the lettuce. And it was just this very strange time in which it was hard to eat on this trip. And not only that, we were going through vast stretches of corporate farming landscapes in which, you know, things were being planted. You weren't sure what exactly GMOs, whatever it was. Things were being sprayed on it. You didn't know what it was. We were going through feedlots like at Coalinga. And, of course, those are very sobering, to say the least. And I just started thinking, this is crazy. We don't know what we're putting in our mouths. This is just nuts. And my husband was driving, and I was fantasizing. And the next thing I knew, I said, I've got this great idea. This is what's going to happen.
What were the ground rules you established for yourself so that you could do this credibly, but also in a way that would work for you and the family?
Well, first of all, I actually wrote down everything I ate for a year because of, you know, this challenge I had set and this sort of disbelief that I was met. I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to prove to people. But the ground rules were that 75% by weight, everything that I ate would come from the quarter acre farm. And if I wanted to go away, for instance, I went away and did a writer's retreat for 2 weeks, I had to eat extra quarter acre farm produce to make up for that 2 weeks that I wasn't going to eat any at all. So I was very stringent about that. The other 25% I could spend any way I wanted. Pasta, cheese, chocolate cake, you know, anything that I wanted. And so that gave me some wiggle room.
Thinking about all the things that you ended up eating from your quarter acre farm, a.k.a. your garden, what would have surprised you the most going into it?
Well, for pure shock value, I actually did eat the snails in our yard.
Because they were eating the lettuce.
That's right. I thought,
so you
hey,
ate them.
Exactly. Fair's fair. But there's a lot of things that were surprising to me that I did eat, including I found out the leaves of a lot of plants were very nutritious. For instance, black-eyed pea leaves have more calcium than milk.
Wow.
And there's a lot of things like sweet potatoes. I started growing sweet potatoes. And sweet potatoes are not only something that grows incredibly well here, which I never hear about anybody growing, but also their leaves are very nutritious and edible as well.
So you were making extra use out of these crops, even eating the parts that you didn't think you'd eat.
Yes, I think that we have a very narrow education about what's edible and what's good to eat that's based on what's easy to get to a supermarket.
If I may, let's get back to the snails, because a lot of us have eaten escargot,
yes,
where you get these shapeless little bits of protein in a little tray, and they're totally covered with olive oil and garlic and so on, and you just slip it in your mouth. Another thing to hunt down these snails like you did, I guess.
Well, if you live in this area, of course, you know that snails are ubiquitous and they're a big problem. But they are the same snails. They're culinary snails. They were brought from France. So it seemed like an okay thing to do, and I did take them. I found them, which was really easy in my garden. You just turn over a log, and there you have them.
And they don't run too fast.
They run slightly faster than I do, but still I managed to creep up on them, so it was okay. And I put them in a terrarium at first, and then I made sort of an escargotier, a place to raise them. And I fed them on lettuces and things that I knew were okay to eat.
So it's like a ranch.
It exactly. And eventually I did them in, which was the hardest thing for me.
Can you tell us what that involves?
Oh my gosh, that involved, first of all, I drowned them in beer, which I thought was the most humane thing to do. If I have to go, that might be all right.
Could be worse ways to go.
That's right. Gin perhaps might be even better. But barring that, so once they're done in, then you have to start putting them through successive changes of water, and they produce an incredible amount of slime. Because they have little capsules inside themselves, little tiny bits of things called mucin, that when a little bit of calcium and then mostly water, when it hits, it expands larger than, say, a car's emergency bag.
Wow.
So they
just have to flush them out, basically.
Yes, and that stuff just keeps producing and producing and producing. And if I had, if I had a little bit less squeamishness about them, I could have, say, applied that slime to my skin, because supposedly it is a fantastic sort of cure-all to all sorts of skin problems.
My guest is Spring Warren, author of The Quarter Acre Farm. It's a book she's written about the year that she spent growing and producing her own food out of what was her lawn, essentially, at the family home in Davis. They produced 75% of the family's food by weight from the garden. Now, we also have a video of you in your garden on our website, capradio.org/insight. Our new multimedia producer, Andrew Nixon, did it, and it's a really nice video. And one thing I've got to say is, looking at the video, your dirt looks awesome. It is so black and rich looking. How do you make it like that?
Oh, man. You know, everything that's in the garden goes back into the garden. And we do have my secret weapon for good garden dirt are our rabbits. So we have two rabbits, and people always look over and say, oh, do you eat them? I say, no, we don't eat them. But they are so useful. We use their manure. And two rabbits produce, by dry weight, as much manure as one full-grown steer in a year. So they are incredibly productive, and the manure builds soil, and you don't have to compost it, you don't have to age it, nothing. You can practically take your rabbit, hold it over your beds, and squeeze if you wanted to. And so between that and the composting of all the garden greens and getting coffee from coffee houses that just give that stuff away, we just make up our own dirt over and over again.
And I guess that dirt is part of the secret behind your chard, because in your blog there's a recipe for cheesy chard grilled sandwich. You added all those E's in the cheesy. And the thing that really stood out for me was the chard. I mean, this was like chard from another planet, from some sci-fi movie. They're huge leaves. I mean, they look great, but how do you grow them like that? Because of the dirt?
I guess so. You know, there are different, I have to be honest, there are different cultivars of chard, and some are going to be smaller and some are going to be larger. But I did have an exceptional chard year, and chard is something that, for those people who are looking for something to grow that's really, really easy to grow, chard is exceptional. And chard also will grow in the winter, and it will grow in the summer.
Wow.
So
I recently grew my first spinach.
Yay.
And while I have no problems pulling every weed out of the ground, I will say this. When it was time to harvest the spinach, I felt squeamish about cutting it off at the ground. It was almost like, of course it's a living thing, but I just felt this connection to the spinach because I'd grown it that I would never have imagined. Do you ever have that problem?
You know, I sympathize greatly. You know, I think that that's one of the reasons that I feel like I take very special care of my garden, is because I feel like once you plant something, it's like getting a pet or an animal, that you then are responsible for it. And so I would say probably in the same way that I feel a lot less negative about people, you know, about eating meat or eating eggs from chickens that I know have a very good life, then I feel much better about eating plants that have had a full and happy and well-tended life as well.
Yeah. Spring Warren's book is The Quarter Acre Farm, How I Kept the Patio, Lost the Lawn, and Fed My Family for a Year. Spring Warren, it was a pleasure talking with you again.
Thank you very much.
And Spring talks about the Quarter Acre Farm this Wednesday evening. She'll be at the Winters Community Library, along with Cammie McBride, who's author of The Herbal Kitchen. The event starts at 6 p.m. You can see the video of Spring in the Quarter Acre Farm at our website, campradio.org/insight. Also at our website, you can hear Joe Rubin's the first part of Joe Rubin's investigative report on the closure of Sacramento's public pools. The second part you can hear tomorrow during Morning Edition here on the station. That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Liz Cazares. The assistant producer, James Morrison. Insight's technical director, Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow.